Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I think part of the sourcing process to me is the most exciting, because you know, you rent a car and you drive through the south of France, and you know, you obviously have some appointments set up, but you know, some of the most exciting things happen when you're just kind of winging it. And you meet a farmer at, you know, a wine fair, and he's, you know, he says, well, come back to my estate, and you're not quite sure where you're going, and you follow a guy in a Peugeot, you know, up a rambling hill, and all of a sudden you come across either a castle or like a shack in the woods, and the guy's making wine out of the back of his, you know, house, or he could be making wine out of a major estate. You know, looks are deceiving, but you want to assume that someone with a very established chateau is making good wine. But 9 times out of 10, the guy out of the garage who's like super passionate is making these better wines, and they're maybe more rustic and less polished. So to me, like the restaurateur, the sommelier, this story resonates with them about the small farmer, you know, the guy who's making wine on small quantities, 80 cases, 100 cases. Those are the things exciting to Barterhouse, and hopefully the things exciting to our clients.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining this afternoon's program of Unfiltered. This is your co-host, Aaron Fitzpatrick. And Brian DeMarco is walking through the door right now after procuring some glassware to open this bottle of 2005 Cuvée Bargeton, Châteauneuf du Pape. This is a Patrick Lasek wine. And Brian had made this grab before leaving the office and thought it was sort of a Rhone day. I'm not 100% sure why. Maybe it's just the fall and the spice, but today's feeling a little bit more like spring. Hey, Bri.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for going to that effort to pick up that stuff for that wine.
I didn't realize our lead-in would be so short.
Yeah, well, you know, got to keep to a schedule over here. I wanted to ask the producers, actually, what number episode this is of Unfiltered. Any help there? All right. Okay.
One of many.
One of many. Yeah. I think we're like almost in the 90s. That's why I was counting down to the 100th episode to figure out what we're going to pop for that.
This is episode 91.
91. All right. Yeah.
I think we're going to have some champagne or something celebratory for the 100th episode.
Definitely.
So let's start counting down from now till then.
Well, I was thinking a little white burgundy would be nice for this afternoon. It's the yesterday was the first day of the bay scallop, the iconic bay scallop harvest. So when I got up in the morning out in the Long Island and looked outside, there were about 50 boats just peppered all throughout the water, which was beautiful. And they were all getting their share of scallops. I think about 2 pounds each were allowed for each boat. So it was pretty cool and a beautiful sight. So looking forward to eating some of those later this week.
Well, that's awesome. I think that 2 pounds a boat doesn't sound like a lot to me. I mean, seriously, yeah. That's a...
Or maybe it's like, it's two bushels. bushels.
That sounds like dinner. But
well, you know, there's less and less fish to go around these days.
Is there now? How does that happen with like the local clamming? I mean, you can get whatever you can sort of dig up, right?
Yeah, you can. We did clamming about a month ago, and there's people out there all the time doing that. But there's certain clams, like the bigger ones, that you shouldn't take home. I guess there's certain rules in terms of sizes. I'm not exactly sure how that goes, but you can definitely get out there and clam. And you can hunt. I've had some venison last week, the first venison of the season. So we had some tips and filet, nice and chewy. I made a little marinade from Will from Sang Lee. We did a little marinade, and we ate those off the grill, which is good, and a little chili, too.
That's always awesome. I mean, I remember moving from, as a high school kid, from from Maryland to Pennsylvania, and my first encounter with deer hunting was really at the age of about 14, and there was one day in school where everybody was wearing orange, And that I was like, well,
the bright orange, the fluorescent,
right, the bright fluorescent orange. I was like, I'm not sure what's happening. And it's basically, oh, it's the first day of deer season, and everyone's allowed to get two deer. So within like a week, no one was wearing orange anymore. And if anyone was, it's clearly that they were not a good hunter, because because there was plenty of deer to go around. In fact, it's interesting now, I think out in Long Island, there's actually an overpopulation of deer.
Yeah, deer are everywhere, and it's quite a problem. But there's a bunch of hunters out now, and you can only shoot bow and arrow, actually, to get those deer. So it's an art for sure.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yep.
I guess it goes back to the Indian days when...
Sure.
So let's see. What vintage is this, the 05?
Yeah, it's delicious.
So, yeah, this Chateauneuf du Pape is singing right off the shelf here.
It would go well with some venison.
Mm.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll have to share this with Jack, our producer, and maybe he'll think of the pizza that goes with said wine.
Indeed,
there definitely needs to be some sort of pig carcass on this pizza. But
well, one other thing I wanted to talk about today was the event that I recently had the privilege to work at in conjunction with the Wine Workshop, which is a sister business to Acro Merrill and Condit Auction House, which was a retrospective of 50 vintages of Chateau Margaux.
That sounds amazing. I mean, that's first of all, a good shout out to our good friend Dave Hamburger, who runs a Wine Workshop and is a friend of the show and a friend in general, and a good guy to know if you're looking to be educated about wine in general or doing some special events. Dave is your guy. So
yeah, and he actually did a show in the first year of the wine program here at Heritage and talked a lot about wine and tasting as sort of a symphony, and how you, and in terms of music, kind of use this parallel between wine tasting and the orchestra. So check out Dave's show in the archive. You want to hear about that a little bit.
Amazing. I mean, I don't know if it's classical music. I liken it more to jazz.
Yeah, he likened it to jazz as well.
Okay, because I thought, you know, Dave and I are actually quite jazz heads, and I thought he would see that as there's like virtuoso, you know, segments where every, you know, there's a common thread throughout jazz, and then there's individual performances that kind of have allowed the individual players to stand out. So kind of wine and music, they kind of have the same vibe. And if you think about tannin as the backbone, and that's kind of your drummer.
Right. You know? There you go. Okay.
That keeps the beat.
Nice. So this event was a two-day event, and people had flown all over the world to attend, from Singapore, Hong Kong, Australia, big Chateau Margaux fans and collectors. And it was, the first night was hosted at 11 Madison Park. And
great restaurant.
Great restaurant indeed. Yeah, the food was fantastic. I didn't get to eat, but it looked really good. and the next day was at Per Se. So certainly two of the best restaurants in New York to complement one of the best wines in the world, this first growth Chateau Margaux. But yeah, so the oldest vintage was dating back to 1900. That was part of the lineup. And
was there any representatives of the Chateau there?
Yeah, Paul Pontellier, who was the managing director of Chateau Margaux, was there on the second day at Per Se and just sat on amongst the table and talked a lot about the history and the different vintages and, you know, just sort of all the characteristic styles of Margaux, which, as some people may know, have a little more of a perfume, a flowery note, as in context of other great Premier Cruz from Bordeaux. So
I think there's, you know, some depending on the vintages. I heard about the oldest one. What were some of your top standout vintages that you got to try?
The 1901 was delicious.
Wow.
Yep. The 1945 and the 1947 were definite standouts.
That's amazing.
Those war years produced some very good wines.
Sounds like it.
The 61.
Well, that's another epic year.
The 83, which again, I think was better than the 82, which is a consensus amongst the wine world. The 1955 was also pretty interesting. And then someone in the group brought a Magnum, Mr. Jim Finkel, who I know Brian is friends with as well. He brought a collector's edition of 1870 Chateau Margaux Magnum to the table.
Wow.
Yeah. And it didn't have a label on it, and it was presumed to be Chateau Margaux based on the provenance and where he bought it from. And it came out of the bottle looking like Pedro Ximénez, you know, like sherry, thick, and
it's smelled always,
that,
you know,
caramelized notes too.
And was it any good?
It was a little bit too much. Yeah, it was just thick and syrupy and brown.
And probably not what it was said it was. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it was interesting, certainly, to try. Fascinating. But
well, it's good that Mr. Finkel is consistent with his risky older vintages. At least he's willing to take a shot.
Yeah, and bring it to the table.
Right, and see how it plays out. I've had a lot of great bottles out of his cellar, and I've had a lot of duds out of his cellar. But I think, again, that's what collecting is all about. And I think the real collectors understand that, you know, not every bottle is going to be perfect. And
exactly.
It's kind of a, you know, wine collecting is like having a fickle mistress. And you know, like Burgundy is the most fickle of those mistresses. And so... I think it really, you have to have a strong stomach and a stronger wallet to,
right, exactly.
To like, you know, cause if you only have one bottle of something and you can be holding it for years and years, hoping for the right day to drink it. And then when you pop it and it's not good, it really breaks your heart.
Well, it was wild. He spent something like, 800 or maybe 400 or 800 minimal amount for this wine when he bought it. Actually, he made a deal. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those things where it was more about the context in which to open it and being at a table with people who would appreciate it, as opposed to continuing to hold it or having opened it, you know, earlier. It wasn't as much about the money, right, as it was just about the right occasion.
Well, and also had it been amazing, it would have been the best $400 or $800 he'd ever spent. And so mm-hmm. it's all context.
Yeah.
So if you had to single out a vintage that was your favorite, what was?
Oh, goodness. I should have taken notes and brought them with me here.
Anything more recent than the 61 that you liked, or the 83?
Yeah, those we tasted on the first day, the first night at the more recent vintages. You could tell that the 05 was quite nice.
But young,
yes, but it had that sort of oomph that you could see developing over the course of time to be a standout wine. What else?
How about the 09 there or no?
No, not the 09. No, we did have a nice chance to taste the 1952 Pavillon Blanc, which is a Sauvignon Blanc also made by Chateau Margaux, which was awesome. Yeah, very, very good. So,
well, Pavillon Rouge is their second wine, and often, like in 96 and 03, that wine is, you know, rivals many of the other first growths, even though it's a second growth wine for Margaux. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, the second label of Latour or Lafite or, you know, whatever. And so I think a lot of people find value in. And sort of the Pavillon Rouge. I remember drinking a lot of the 96 and being very grateful that I could afford that compared to the
absolutely.
First growth.
Yeah. You got to look for those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what else is cooking in your bag of tricks over there?
So what else? I mean, having been away for a couple of weeks, I have been able to bring back a few bits of additional knowledge to the table. I was in Oaxaca, which is the state in Mexico, which produces the most amount of mezcal, and definitely had some chance to taste a bunch of boutique mezcals from the area.
Well,
I'm
going
to send Carlos and Jack a few pictures of some of them so we could put them on the website as well. Yeah, so it was really neat.
I've actually had the pleasure to travel through Oaxaca, and a good friend of mine, Robin Goldstein, actually wrote a book about Oaxaca.
Oh, really?
for Fodors.
Cool.
And in his book, he discovers a lot of the mezcal producers. And it's funny because if you really understand, you know, scotch,
right,
then you know, mezcal is Mexican scotch.
Mm-hmm.
And to think about mezcal and having smoky elements and, you know, some resonances of tequila, but more of the wood and the care and sort of the aging that you would think about with Scotch. It's such a unique product.
Yeah.
And as far as value for money, I mean, they're not, there's some very expensive ones, but
yeah, but most, I say the more expensive ones don't top, you know,
not at
60,
all.
80 retail. So $60, well, it's also, $80
retail. The demand is less and people, right. people are less likely to covet them the way they would, single malt scotches.
Yeah. And some of the Frenchies have likened it to, you know, a Mexican cognac, if you will, as well. So in the same right. sort of vein, when you start looking at it, there are so many different varieties of agave, and the one that we're talking about here is the maguey. And when you think about the different grape varieties and wine production and the range of different production available in the same way with agave that's suitable for mezcal production, you can think about how these different varieties and microclimates within Oaxaca will transform the end product. So I think that's one of the cool things when you think about, you know, the diverse sort of climate in Oaxaca in terms of overall Mexico. It's really sort of an interesting topography. You have the Pacific Coast, you have the mountains, you have a lot of a verdant landscape. So you have a really interesting geographical distinction, which then kind of offers differentiation and taste for the different agave plants as well. So mm-hmm. very, very cool. So, you know, to help our listeners a little bit understand the difference between the more popular tequila
mm-hmm.
and mezcal, we look at tequila as the blue agave plant. And then,
correct.
And then mezcal, we're really talking about the maguey, or, you know, a differentiation between the different plants that you used and then the production of it as well.
Well, I mean, the distillation is relatively similar. Mm-hmm. But imagine that if you're talking about tequila, you're thinking, you know, the stuff that's añejo is usually what sees oak.
Right.
And a lot of the platas or the silvers and tequila are just straight up, you know, distillation the way you would think about vodka, but just, you know, using obviously different means of raw ingredients. Whereas mezcal, correct me if I'm wrong, is really more of a barrel process for most of the production. I mean, you're doing...
Yeah, for most of it. You can still do the blanco, which is just a very clean, you know, Hoven sort of style. But yeah, in general, you're looking at minimum 8 months, a year for, right. for aging. Yeah.
And this is what captures people's imagination. It's not, you know, obviously you can make moonshine anywhere.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other factor to think about in terms of that smoky quality, which is a differentiation for mezcal, is the way that it's cooked under the earth. So you mm-hmm, have a little pit dug, and then you have some rocks put on top of that, which have the wood, and they burn so that it cooks this this plant, the piña, which is the core of the plant, and then that's made into a mash. And then there's other things that could be added to that mash, whether it's herbs or pineapple, or sometimes mm-hmm. they even use a capon or a chicken in
is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. It is
wild.
True. So that extra fat is believed to impart a little more of a textural sort of creaminess and whatnot to the end product.
So there's chicken fat in, you know, in mezcal. Is that what you're trying to tell me? I love
so,
that.
Well, some producers mm-hmm. might use that, you know, after in the distillation, you know, after it's been smoked, you know, then adding this this chicken or a capon to offer a different element. So.
Because
yeah.
this Chateauneuf du Pape 05 has got a lot of fat on it right now.
Yeah, it does.
Here, can I give you another sip?
Indeed, yes.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure this is from chickens, but
it's pretty concentrated. This particular
yeah,
particular
this is their
wine.
This is
yeah.
their top cuvée, and because due in large part to my friends at Lot 18. Shout out to Janine Rodolph and Denny at Lot 18. Thank you, kids, for cleaning me out of the rest of the Chateauneuf du Pape I have from Patrick Lissac.
Oh, really? Okay.
This is the last that I have, and we're pretty psyched that I was able to stash them for our own supply. I mean, so we have some in the studio and
just a pickling of some bottles left, right?
Yes, yes. You know, we have to make sure that the house gets some.
Thank you.
of course. The Patrick Lissac Chateauneuf du Pape have been selling like hotcakes on the web retailer Lot 18. And I think that we had a little news about them recently. They just got a new capitalization and another round of a few, you know, double digit teen $1 million, $20-30 million in recapitalization. So they look like they're here for the long haul.
Good for them, man.
And so, I mean, what that really means is that online wine sales don't seem to be dissipating. In fact, they probably will increase.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this puts a lot of strain on your local retailer.
Yeah, it does, right?
I think so.
I mean, there have been a few out there, but Lot 18 really seems to have been able to corner that particular market, or maybe it's just my perception, but it seems like they're growing and more jobs that they're looking to offer to help fill those demands.
And they're not just wine jobs. I think a lot of tech jobs, and it's, we had Silicon Alley here, I guess, 5-6 years ago. There was a lot of tech jobs down in Tribeca, or I guess through the Flatiron down through Tribeca. And you kind of don't hear about that anymore. But now it's fun to see that there's still these engineering and web jobs available, and now they're on the wine tip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so mm-hmm. you know, as whatever the medium, as long as we're selling more wine and we're getting it out there, I think we're safe in our jobs, Aaron.
Yeah. Well, on that positive note, we're going to take a short break and be right back.
Hey everyone, welcome back to this week's episode, episode 91.
Episode 91
of Unfiltered.
On the 8th of November, which is election day.
Wow.
In some places.
And it's flag day in Lithuania. I'm your host, Brian DeMarco, with your lovely and talented co-host, Miss Aaron Fitzpatrick. And we're back to, we've discussed Chateau Margaux, and we've discussed Chateauneuf du Pape. That we're drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And
lightly glazed over mezcal, which is a much more complicated topic, which I think we should dig into on another show and bring in a few to taste.
I think we should not only bring it in, but we should bring in a mezcal expert and have
Yeah, we should. We get Phil Ward from Malwell over here and maybe have him talk a little bit about that. Then there's a whole other aspect of the worm, the larva, which has been sort of the notoriety of mezcal as an export item is having that worm inside the bottle. And the Mexican government has tried to crack down on that to improve the overall image of mezcal.
And I think the worm hurts it. I think it's a gimmick, and I don't think it really, I mean, back when I was of a more suitable drinking age, where tequila and mezcal were in my weekly diet,
good on you,
right? Like foosball and college and tequila. I mean,
quesadillas for breakfast,
exactly, not just for breakfast anymore. the worm was like the whole thing. If you're drinking the bottle, and whoever had the last sip with the worm was, you know, I don't know if you were tripping or some sort of like you know, I don't know. There was some legend involved with it that really escapes me. But
well, there's a few. There's a few reasons that it was in there. I mean, I think it's actually a caterpillar, which is like an infestation to the actual plant. So that was it was put in the bottle to prove that there was a high enough alcohol content. So that was sort of, you know,
could kill the larva.
right.
So what was probably a production flaw became like folklore.
Right. There are a few other legends, but yeah, it's sort of one of those, I'd say, controversial issues in terms of people thinking it's a valuable marketing tool and it could get their product because people are like, oh, it's sort of this cool people, you know, remember Goldschlager and having those little gold flakes gold floating in there.
Sure.
Yeah. People are more apt to buy it if there's some sort of novelty of it. But it also has been presumed to add a distinct flavor to the mezcal, like a smoothness as it.
Right, tastes like butterfly.
Yeah, there you go.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, let's put that on the docket to explore.
I agree. I mean, further. I think that's a whole show unto itself.
Yeah.
So I was just reading here at Heritage Worldwide Headquarters that we're in November, obviously, and the turkey season's around the corner. So we're going to do our plug is probably for the next 2 or 3 weeks for Heritage turkeys and
Turkvember. Yeah, moving on from Goat-tober to Turkvember.
And the need to not only support local farmers, but you know what you're putting in your body, and that, you know, nothing against butterball turkeys at the grocery store, but I think that the listeners of this show are all better people than that, and that we implore you to go out and search for Heritage products, especially your turkeys.
And do you know what you're going to be drinking on Turkvember Day?
Everything that I decide to steal from my office the day before will come with. And I'm not sure. Usually it's my job to provide the booze. So I don't know. I mean, I think Rhone wines always go great, and mm-hmm. white Burgundy never fails, and having some rosé.
I was going to say, rosé is always nice, at least with little bubbles in there.
Especially champagne rosé is fabulous with turkey. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, we have one producer, Grand Bazan, who has a winery in Valencia. It's called Master Bazan. Shout out to you, Jesus, if you're listening while you're in Spain.
So they have the Rioja Baixa's Albariño production, and then they have a southern Spain production as well.
They do, and they may make a rosé, which they only bring out in October. They release it in October for Thanksgiving, and they only probably make, you know, 6,000 bottles of it, and they sell all of it in 6 or 7 weeks.
Really?
And it's all for the holiday season. So whereas someone from Provence would do rosé for the summer or spring summer release, the Spaniards, at least that I'm working with in this particular instance, are releasing their rosé for Thanksgiving. I mean, that couldn't be more appropriate, right?
And that's purposefully done?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise it would be a suicidal mission to release rosé in the winter.
No, I know, but they must. I mean, that's just kind of...
It's a darker rosé. It's made with Bobal,
okay,
which is an indigenous grape from the Valencia region, and it's purposely higher in alcohol because I just think that's the kind of fruit they're getting, and the extraction on that fruit, and it's a darker red, so it's almost more apple-y in color than a red apple than mm-hmm. it would be. Classic, you know, salmon-colored rosé from Provence. But yeah, so that's something to look out for, folks, is rosé.
Some rosé for turkeys. For turkeys. I like that.
So let's table that for next week when we get closer to Thanksgiving, and we'll have a full on Thanksgiving drink fest to see what we should have.
I think the time will be right then, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and probably there'll be another cold spell or a freak hailstorm on us at that point, and we'll be wanting to warm up with something.
Absolutely. Well, hey, this is great having you back in the studio, Aaron.
Oh, thanks. It's lovely to be here. Yeah, I missed Max too. Nice. Or Rex.
Oh, Rex.
Rex, yeah. Our hog on the wall there. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm going to be looking for some of his parts in a couple of weeks. Yeah. I want some wild boar. You know,
nice.
That'll be fun.
Awful included.
Well, but anyway, hey, I can't believe it's our time is up. It's another successful episode under our belt.
A little wrap. Yep.
Yeah, well, take us out, Aaron.
Thank you for joining us today, November the 8th, and join us every Tuesday, 4 p.m. on heritageradionetwork.com. Enjoy this lovely evening outside, and we will see you soon. Drink well.
The following is a message from Jones Family Farms. Jones Family Farms is a 400-acre working farm offering quality agricultural products all year round, from fresh summer berries to Christmas trees in the winter, and an award-winning winery that is open from April to December. The reach of the Jones Family Farms is hard to capture, from their advocacy work through the Working Lands Alliance to ongoing classes in the Harvest Kitchen. Jones Family Farms is as passionate about education as it is about farming. Whether you're picking fresh strawberries or exploring local wines, we hope you're inspired to learn more about Connecticut farming. Visit www.jonesfamilyfarms.com for more information.